Hello, my name is Phil. Let me just pull this up here real quick. I'd like to thank Brian, by the way. Those poems were excellent. I thought I was going to have a fucking flashback over there, like, Jesus Christ. So, it's been a while since... I know it's been a while since I've been here to read, and this is one I've not read here before, but it's actually the first poem I ever wrote back in 2010, if I can just... You can give me just a moment here. Sorry, my phone is... Ben Jacks here. I wrote this in 2010. It was actually the first poem I ever wrote. And I've actually never read it out loud to anybody. It's entitled XX December 2009. What the f? Bill Gates has got to get his shit together. Microsoft is killing me. All right. XX December 2009. Shit. It's what I smell and what I say every single day. What a day off, what a day. Cold sweat is nothing like fermented sweat. Disintegrates my ACUs, cold clammy headsets, chafed gonads and yellowed iPros. What a day. They say, or at least I'm told, our sense of smell takes the greatest hold of all of our memories. They couldn't go to war in a clean country. You couldn't send to war a clean bunch of kids. Today is the day I sit in back. I'm just a gib, that guy in the back. In the stream of a dream in downtown Baghdad, smells like shit, fucking ARAC. I'll never forget you, brother. I'll never leave you behind. You sit there and analyze poetry by Langston Hughes about the Euphrates and the enslavement of the Africans and Jews. What the fuck do you know, you who only see what you choose? This is what people do to each other. This is what happens in the world. This is why I was needy in the month of December. Because you needed a break and you needed space while I was over 3,000 miles away. A week after you had said, oh my God, I feel so bad, that must have affected you. I love you, it had to have. Sorry I'm so needy. Sorry I can't get over it. I never got shot at on that day. I know that makes me a fag. I know they're not American. I know it's only Hodge, but I'd be blind, deaf, paralyzed to not smell that day. I looked for body parts that morning, but I think none were left in the massive epicenters where the blood was still wet, and all I see is the smell of burned flesh. I want to go home. My heart is raging like every dead person was the prettiest girl, and I had to talk to them all. I just want, I need to lay down, crank the AC, jerk off with animal desperation, and smell those letters you wrote to me.
Right, the next person up on the op mic is the only person in the room on the op mic tonight that's a rock star. They only have one name, Molly.
The fright of misspelling, of absent-minded mistelling, spit focus relayering, recomposing the decomposing. The warm stench of warm regurgitation. The soft sigh of spent skin as it floats to the floor. The fingertips have forgotten the feeling of the inner lining of the leaf, the huff of a hosta, the squish of a raspberry half rotten in ripeness. Apples fecund drag the branches down with reckless swelling. Heart hopping in the throat box. Running free as if in someone else's sitting room during the day when no one is home. A rabbit hole appears in an uncovered section of the compost. A natural door laying claim to compost, an exit entrance for those hopping creatures of many exits and entrances. How much time do they spend below ground on an average day? Heart hopping in the throat box, like a rabbit at a newly made warren exit. Pushing through pores like a rabbit nose through clay, through soil recomposed from decomposed inner leaf linings. Up, up, up into calendar days and working clocks.
Thank you. you're going to answer the question of how much time do you spend underground every day, I suggest you get a therapist before you do that. Next up is Jack Short.
Shrinking up the mic. Thanks, Sven. This is a panto, and it's called Next Day's Motto. I wrote it based on my experience of working with people with Down syndrome and my entire working life, really. I'm working with autism, Down syndrome people, young people, struggling, and it would be, it's reflecting my own struggle in educating with around sexual education, capacity issues, sexual rights, sexual needs, a whole lot. So it's called Next Day's Motto. The motto for today is sex is okay. It's normal to want to go to bed together. Despite our disabilities, we're adults, they said. We can have a relationship. That's what we learned today. It's normal to want to go to bed together, to want kissing and touch. And we can have a relationship. That's what I heard anyway. Not like before, when because of our minds, to want kissing and touch was inappropriate, they called it. Not like before, when because of our minds, we couldn't make a safe choice, they told us. But it's not inappropriate, that's what we learned today. They'll show us how to use condoms, and then we can make a safe choice, they told us. They'll answer our questions the next day, they said. They'll show us how to use condoms, despite our disabilities, we're adults, they said. They'll answer our questions the next day, they said. Sex is okay, that's the motto for today. Yay!
You can take that motto for the day as literally as you like. As long as it's consensual. Next up is Mr. Benjamin Barnes.
Gesticulating wildly to Cezanne's third symphony turned up so loud the violins descend in a squall. Articulating the freedom of being temporarily alone, bouncing up and down on the sofa as organ pipes tumble through the sandstone wall and the storm in Beethoven's pastoral rages and the cat is a black ball of coal ablaze and the smoke of each gesture is amplified by a terrible megaphone and timpani and pots and pans. And was it Ursula Le Guin who said that each departure is a return? And was it in the left hand of darkness or in the dispossessed? It's teeming rain inside the house which prevents anything from getting done and causes the cat to hiss and go out, unlike all the spring primroses which nod unblinking into dark tunnels that go on forever in the paranoid mind dismissed. To sleep so close together you improvise between my dreams, in the space where legs interlock like lovely lingering ghosts of last night's breath, and Babe the Piglet saves the day, and we listen to Madonna and you prepare crepes, dispelling this linguistic fever.
Thanks, Ben. I don't know if you noticed, right in the middle of that was one of the new marketing phrases to get the Americans come to Ireland. It's teeming rain inside the house. Find that, McCarthy.
Night vision. Every night after the strike, Hassan would send himself to heaven. He'd shut his supernova eyes, press his brow against a rug, and burst into a million liberated moons. He'd rip the bar strap off the world, let east go west, grasp the hot palm of the Pleiades, and stroke the lion's brow, lead the morning maidens down the star spine. But one night, in the boundless sea of universe, he grew cool as onion milk, weary of the light that bombed the earth. So he followed the course of a drone through his hellfire, American prick of composite steel, smart to its exact parts, and shot into the face of the sun, blinding God.
Thanks, Barbara. I'll talk to you later on about my favourite line in that, I'm not going to mention it in public. Next up is Linda Ibbotson.
A new one from the Paris Sketchbook, inspired by Eric Satie. I don't know how to pronounce that, Eric Satie. He wrote the Gymnopédies, I know Bernadette will know, but he also wrote the Ogives, and he was inspired by a doorway in Notre Dame, where an ogive is a doorway, and it comes up like that, and it's like an arch to a point. So, I don't know how the refugee crisis got in this poem, but that's poetry, you can say anything. So, the morning tasted of flambéed apricots and discontent, as I unfold a flotilla of paper boats cut out from the shape of bones. I take my brush, paint war and erase, decide to paint a dove to cover cracks in the sea. In the distance I saw a nomad thread the world through a hole in the sky, place a mirror at his throat to reflect the source of all things. He read the palms of bone black statues, whose names I do not know, hung the words in the mouths of seabirds to dry. I imagine a scene from Jean Cocteau, a room lined with French wallpaper, and a lily that sits on water, leaves so large you could sail on them, white origami flowers that float like the paper boats. I watch petals pray in the shape of a doorway, an ogive I walked through in Notre Dame.
Those of you who are too poor to actually go to Paris, you can just hang up with Linda for a while. It's basically the same thing. Been in there. Yeah. No, I'm going to suggest you close your eyes for the next person on the open mic, because it's much better that you feast your ears on the dulcet tones of Charles Clark.
Well, he looks good as well.
It won't be done. Not really adults. In fact, it's a bit of prose. I simply couldn't find the poem when I was missing last week. I think I'll find it. This is just a small thing. I was in the National Gallery on Friday looking at a very brash collection of paintings by Nolde, who had the misfortune, if you put it like that, of being a supporter of the Nazis, but the Nazis didn't like his poetry, his paintings, and banned him. He was degenerate, and so on. So he had to go and retire to the borders of Denmark, where he painted tiny pictures like that. Well, not intended for. But anyway, that's not what it's about. In the gallery, hung on the line in the National Gallery of Ireland, are a number of paintings from the French 19th century by Theodore Rousseau, one of the men of 1835, Diaz de la Peña, Protestant, Charles-Emile Jacques, painter of sheep, Foyon, painter of cows, and Meissonier, horses in the snows of Russia, who made himself immensely rich, which was the cause of Manet's making art a career. Most paintings, I've cut that bit out. I was in the gallery one day when a group went past these pictures, and a Frenchman, Turkish something, smartly dressed, glanced at the Jacques and said, "Oh, the lovely sheep." He may even have said it in French. It was sarcastic in any case. And when you think of it, he had a point. Was poor old Charles-Emile reduced to painting sheep, and why? We can dismiss the idea that there was a medical cause or kink. It seems obvious that sheep were fashionable, not to the same extent as cows, which have a long history in Dutch art, or in any case, more valuable in the marketplace. Even our own Nathaniel Hone the Younger did a painting called Sheep in Glenmalure, though he had the excuse of becoming a farmer when he inherited 300 acres of Rohini. He also painted cows and yachts, as is well known. Sheep were less thought-provoking, and people who were wealthy enough to buy paintings don't want to have to think. And particularly not when they're at the dinner table. All these paintings came from Chester Beatty, a mining engineer who became very rich indeed and was a very great collector. What an accumulation, beyond manuscripts, prints, stuff bottles, paintings, and much, much more. Giving a lot of it away must have seemed a solution to an old problem. You can't take it with you.
Said it before, I'll say it again. It's worth it coming just for Charles. Next up is Niamh Toomey.
This one doesn't really have a name. After you died, you became enormous. A stone in every step. Tinnitus. Garlic breath. Suddenly, from every spot bloomed a memory, and you lived 100 times over in every head of cinnamon curls I saw from behind. Sometimes I followed your bouncing curls down the street, standing back, willing the head not to turn and show the face of someone else so you would die again.
Thank you, Niamh. That was lovely. Patricia Walsh.
Thank you, Sanders. The title of this poem is called Dollface. It's a term of endearment that some people take exception to. Dollface. Colorful strictures with a dollar milk. Working for money instead is convenient. Sucker punch to happiness, hardwired goals, a rare form of satisfaction blows in the mind. Skulking with intent near the bright paintings, unrecognizable folks fly by afternoons, forgettable expense at point of some returns, sitting next to a freak show, a punishing stunt. What should go wrong will, pitch past in ridicule, parsimony to high art, mending, not ending. One best customer falling by the wayside. Eating more for effect, alcohol a first resort. Potential for screaming, a character foretold. Cued mathematics creating us to define itself. Congregating around the imaginary plaza. Photographing the last best of effects alone. The slow burn is red. Finding out the closest closets. Really free, hitting on another successive. Promising fame on the back of a borrowed laptop. Composing oneself on a boat for extinction. Stock props ring true for a little while longer. Looking for twists in a lesser plot. Under guarantee for a spell being. Middle to the end. Over. Direct speech. Thanks.
Thanks, Trish. Are you one of those people who takes offence to being called Dollface? Are you?
No,
thanks.
A lot of people would.
Yeah, thanks, Dollface. Next up is Damien O'Shea.
So the poem I'm going to read, I wrote when I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And full disclaimer, things really haven't changed for me since. I call it the journey. As I grow old and the years pass by, I sit and I pause and wonder and sigh. Why did I choose the path that I tread and what's to come in the years ahead? Was I led this way? Did I follow a dream? Am I simply a leaf on life's flowing stream? Did I make a mistake? Did I turn the wrong way? When others stuck to the path, did I run away? How long can I go before I fall down and scream? And what does it take to follow a dream? Do I know what I want? Did I follow my heart? Can I turn back now? I'm so far from the start. Did I lose myself along the way? Did I wander off course? Did I somehow stray? And if I did, was it all in vain to search just to find myself again? My mind spins round with questions and doubts on the journeys we take and what life is about. And I come to realize a plain simple truth, that wisdom offsprings from the loss of our youth. Life tears away, brings us struggles and fears. True heartbreak, regrets and bittersweet tears. Friendships made and loves lost. Letting time dry your eyes. Recalling joyous hellos. Forgetting tearful goodbyes. Yet time carries on and the years they roll by. And too soon they're gone in the blink of an eye. Trading wisdom for youth, and it's been a fair trade. I must stick to my course and decisions I've made. The future ahead is one yet I must build. Days to come in a life as yet unfulfilled. Holding true to my past and my path to transcend and find my way through till the journey's end.
Thanks, Damien. I wish I traded my youth for wisdom. Fucking hell. Conor McManus is next.
Thanks, Sam. This is part of a memoir I'm working on. It was 1987, the end of the Ed Koch era. I was 21. New York was broken in decay. Murder and rape were at an all-time high, and crack cocaine was devastating the poor communities, while billions flooded into Wall Street to be handled by coke addict traders. Dwight Gooden was in rehab, said the Daily News. Eight murdered in Lockall, said the Subway Walls. And Lady in Red played on an endless loop on the radio. It had already been a hit at home, and now it had followed me all the way across the Atlantic. The heat was the first thing that hit me when I got off the plane in JFK. I'd never felt anything like it, and I still remember it. For some reason or other, I kept pronouncing it hate, the way the old men would at home. And I played with the word in my head, repeating it over and over. Within a week, I had a job got and a girlfriend called Dee. The job was in Hell's Kitchen, working for two small Maltese brothers. We were refurbing a four-floor walk-up on 47th and 9th. The thing was completely gutted. Floors had to be laid, walls erected, plumbing and electrical installed. I started at 7, but even at that hour, 47th and 9th played it by night runs. The prostitutes hadn't gone home, the junkies were still high, and there was no shortage of lunatics, bums and drugs. The derelict streets between 9th and the Hudson were strewn with condoms, and the prostitutes strutted their stuff through the early morning traffic on 10th. I was still there in November when an ice cold wind blew in off the river, and all they wore were waist-length leather jackets, high heels, tights, and makeup. Every day I hung sheetrock, drank Pepsi, ate tuna sandwiches, and dreamt about travelling the world on a motorbike. And every day Howie asked me if I wanted a tomato on my tuna, and every day I said no. But that went on for weeks. It was like he was an autopilot, programmed to put tomato on everything. It irritated the hell out of me, but I said nothing. At night, for $10 an hour cash, I spotted ink stains, chewing gum, coffee stains, nail polish, from the carpets of Manhattan skyscrapers. Where the chemical cleaning agent didn't work, I used vodka, purloined from a press in the office of one of the chief executives. On Saturdays, I worked for myself. I put small ads in the local freebie and did small jobs, laid floors, fitted locks, that sort of thing. Once I got a job from a Polish landlord. We were sitting in this big wreck of a Buick in the car park of White Castles, and I remember clearly the big V8 engine rumbling beneath us as he said he'd give me $100 for the job. He'd bring me there, drop me off, come collect me. He had just bought the apartment and was renting it out and didn't want the tenants to know he was a Polak, he said. It was in Bushwick, and he wanted me to change the lock on the door for him. The neighbourhood was full of guineas and spicks, he said, and he was letting on he was a Jew. So you think it's okay for me to go in there, I asked. Yeah, sure, you're a Mick. Better still, Black Irish. It was sweltering and everybody was waiting for the weekend to go up, to get out of town and head up to Catskills, or out to Rockaway Beach, and by this stage I was browning up real well. They'll think you're one of their own, he said and burst out laughing. Yeah, until I open my mouth, I said. Well, don't open your goddamn mouth then, he said. So I started into changing the lock on 3A, but all I wanted to do was get out of there. There I was, a Mick, pretending to be a spick, working for a Polite, pretending to be a kike. I didn't remember much about the place. I didn't remember much about the place except it was dirty and overrun with cockroaches. And the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen exited from 3B. Hi, she said, and chatted easily as she triple-locked and dead-bolted her door. Hispanic, rich black hair, a tight red dress. I was bursting to say hi, but all that went through my head was, well, don't open your goddamn mouth. I just smiled and kept stumped. After 2 hours, he came back, picked me up, bought me a White Castle's burger worth $1, and handed me $60. Said it was all he had, poor like. Anyway, one morning I got into 47th Street a little earlier than usual, and Howie was standing in the doorway of his deli, broom in hand, staring at a blonde walking along the sidewalk. As she paraded up and down, she had her skirt lifted, no underwear, and a hand massaging each cheek. It took a lot to faze Howie, but he said he'd seen it all now. He said he could die happy. I told Howie I wasn't sure whether it was a man or a woman. Howie said he didn't care. On my days off, I'd go into Dee's grandmother for lunch. We'd sit and talk about America while she smoked long white cigarettes. Or I'd go up to Joe Gunning in the Murray Plowboy on Greenpoint Avenue and hang with him and talk about home. Or I'd meet Dee for lunch and we'd sit in Battery Park and watch the squirrels scavenge from the garbage cans beneath the Twin Towers. On Thursday nights we frequented Horgan's for steak and salad with blue cheese sauce and went up to Sidetracks or to Breffni on Queens Boulevard to watch her play pool. She was good at pool. Her father had taught her and then left. Then over to Sally O'Brien's and Billy Mulligan's, full with young Irish. Late on Saturday nights, as the yell shook overhead, we had sex in a motel room we rented for an hour, with stained sheets that you collected at reception on your way in, and handed them back at reception on your way out. We spent Thanksgiving in a jacuzzi on Long Island, and holidayed the following summer in Ocean City, Maryland. There we stayed in an old clapboard hotel on the waterfront, the windows permanently open, the warm salt sea air easing through. We bodyboarded all day, and ate at a smorgasbord along the boardwalk in the evening. Crab claws, or steak and milk, all you could eat for just $10. And afterwards we had more sex, and both of us slept for Ireland. Thank you.
You know you're in a serious relationship when you're going into a hotel collecting sheets on the way in. Can't believe it's not still together, Connor. Can't believe it. All right, next is our five-word challenge champion, Jenny DeBee.
Go introducing me like that, because that means y'all expect this to be good. It's probably not, but anyway, this is a poem called Literary Studies. I encourage my students to read Ovid, Dante, Milton, to familiarize themselves with the seminal works so that they may better understand the text that we will be, and they ask me what seminal means. This is how semen leaks into my classes. There, always there, in wild secrets, in Byron's passions, in Shakespeare's moor, with a pillow to his beloved's lips, the vital fluids of literature. And they tell me it's a little sexist. And I could explain to them the historical disparity between the number of learned men and the number of educated women, and the way this unevenness is always going to skew the scales if you're counting written works from the beginning of forever. and I could wax long about Sappho, fractured daughter of Lesbos, and I could give them Marjorie Kemp, who wrote herself into the Bride of Christ, or to Marie de France and Mary Wollstonecraft, squared, making three mothers of three monsters in three different centuries. I could give them Dickens and Bronte sisters and Plath, but only before she stuck her head in that oven. I could lay in their hands Kate Chopin and Zora Neale Hurston to give them warnings about rising tides. I could tell them the legend of Harper Lee and her one perfect book, but that legend isn't true anymore. I could take them to that house on Mango Street, trade them agua para chocolate, and teach them to be girls that the baker allows to squeeze the bread. I could tell them that B. Potter drew Flopsy and friends so perfectly only because she spent her childhood dissecting carrion. I could lay a finger on the unbalanced scale, but that won't be on their test. Thank you.
There's a couple of additions here. One is you kind of let the audience decide whether it's any good or not. And the second one is if you're the winner of the 5-word challenge, that's how we introduce you. I'm sorry about that. Try it down the stairs the next time you say that to me, as you know. I'm going to get this name wrong, I know, but it's Louisa Daly. Have I got that right, Bob?
Conversation starts and my blood boils, not for no reason, but a particular reason. I do not consider myself a feminist, but an equalist. A sensitive topic, but yes, of course. I hear of continuous words, sexual assault in women. It's been around and around and I feel so dizzy. But what about the men whose masculinity is tested when he feels vulnerable? The man whose sleep is disturbed with the nightmares relived of guns, beer and... Sorry. But most of all, wandering hands unwanted. Aggression that bursts out of control, but no fault of his own, but of others. Heads turn to ignore what they know is morally wrong. That is misuse of the power. That will later impact more lives than they can possibly imagine. A daughter questions her father and says and sees as his behaviour changes when she becomes older. The father's response, I'm a victim of sexual abuse. The daughter's response, which is me, no, you are a survivor.
Thank you for sharing that. Really appreciate it. Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, this is a short thing that it's actually a song, but it actually kind of works well, I think, spoken well, we'll see. It's about a 10-year relationship that lasted, for as long as it lasted. Okay, so here goes. I held back your hair when you were puking up at the side of the road. Lucozade and chicken pieces left for the crows. I put you to bed like you were a kind of stroke victim and you whispered randy bullshit I kind of chose to ignore. You and I. Forgiven? Forgiven. I held the baby when you nearly bled to death. Doctors and nurses rushing around with scalpels and needles. The midwife nearly killed me when I was sucking on the nitrous oxide. But I didn't care. You and him were still alive. You and I. Forgiven. Like strangers on a train that know it will eventually come to a stop. Like passive observers who step off and wave goodbye. You and I. Forgiven? No.
Shula is a song another night, so as we can compare and contrast. No, I've been having such a great time, I haven't really been watching the clock, and we're really tight for time now. So we've got a few poets left, just please, please keep it short. Max Creedon is next.
Okay, I've just been looking at photographs, I'm doing improv sketches and poems of them. I do one short poem, and squeezing my 5-word challenge, I always do. So this is the...
I draw now, man.
Yeah, this is really short now.
I draw.
I tell you, you talk to Conrad Lannis and talk to me then. The five horses trashed the shallows, they're there, of the Camargue. And five horses trashed the shallows, thundered through Camargue. Forelocks aloft, nostrils flare and yearn, waves flowing free astern in the dark. Cannonbone and Carnet, pastern to Fetlock Groove. The waves rolled to stiffle joint, splashed the Gascon, Fetlock, Hock and Hump. Five withers leave the with glance, leave their old Rhone Delta home. No guardians to guide to the bullring now, their Birkhorpe once in ebony, now greying into age. Ears short and Fetlocks full, they come to me and plot their arc. Cavallo del Delto, halter in pitiable assault, and stare at me in shock. Which face the other most? Do they fear the branding or being the gelding of poor stock? I will leave the 5 words over.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Max, and thanks for just doing one. Really appreciate it. Now it's time for a Jimprica. So this is called Apartment Witches. I just wanted to kind of see, like, how would witches be in the 21st century? Jocasta and Zaza live in number 47. They tell neighbours they're sisters, but really they're lesbians. Nobody would care, but witches are secretive. At night, they sit on their balcony holding hands and sipping elderflower gin. They observe the clutter of city lights and can tell from the colour how lonely the city feels. Bright sulphur means a spinster got a ring around her finger. Phosphorus means a therapist is crying somewhere. Zaza squeezes Jocasta's hand, glad she's not alone out there. Hecate, their black cat, walks over purring against legs of the table. They feed him a vegan treat. When they're short of dosh, they resort to magic spells. They don't have a fireplace, but stream one off their smart TV. They break tofu as an offering and toss it in the miso broth. They refuse to use murderer's blood, eye of newt, or a serpent's tooth, because it takes a second to kill but can take forever to heal. They chant over their cauldron on a hot plate plugged into the wall, praying green gods will make it rain. They wait a day or two and maybe they'll win an old prize bond or get tax back or find a wallet. If the underworld doesn't pick up the phone or answer the Ouija board, one will call their mother. When they say they're self-sufficient, they mean they shoplift. They only do it if they're desperate. Being a full-time witch is precarious. They have mice trained to creep into shops at night and gnaw wires. They walk around moonlit shops, browsing at leisure, filling baskets with whatever. But they always make sure the universe will reimburse, even if corporations can afford it. They slip an IOU note in an envelope and drizzle it with honey and salt and chant, "Let the great universe pay." They're not sure if that works, but don't mention that to each other. Saturday nights they invite other witches around. Hecate climbs on the kitchen cupboard and watches above. They dress in synthetic leather, put top shop rings on all 13 fingers, coal smeared over their eyelids into perfect flicks. Their friends accuse them of twinning and make jokes about the lesbian urge to merge. They laugh because their friends are right. After pre-drinks, they go to Fred Zeppelin's and drink bug-fast cocktails. Witches don't take drugs because they're perpetually tripping on otherworldly visions. The witches shriek in the corner, outdoing one another, producing shrunken heads on a table for a laugh,
telling stories of their dark gingerbread past. They want to scare, they scare wannabe goths out of the room. When neighbours ask what they do, the witches always say, poet. It's the perfect conversation killer. Nobody knows how to respond to it. Why work when they can spend days together? They take Hecate out on a leash and walk the streets, feeling rich off of each other's company.
I'm going to kill another conversation by saying the word poet. Philip Spiller.
Thank you, Sam. This is an oldie now, I guess. It's usually I'm a youth to play this, but sure, I'll do it after tonight. It's a mixture of mythology, memory hair. Upon my head grows memory hair, and where I step grows fungi. So I walk in a circle, letting them bud out, crisp, white, and spongy. Slowly, while they age and grow, they become stone. A stone circle more profound and amplified, in mystic and power, because they somehow echo the moon's sunlight. In my own dreaming track, I backtrack to the spot, retracing the old mushroom road I laid long before. Where is Yanga with a rainbow cloak? I mean, antlers branched out, smothered with leaves of amber. Because I've aged, I've become bold. I've lost my memory hair. Becoming weary in my travels, I ghost in younger orange remains. Becoming useless and lost. And what's frightening is, I feel myself losing it more. I feel like a reaper walking among Gaia's turf bosom.
Added time, as they say. Ciarán McArdlin is next. McArdlin.
It's called I Need Time. I need time. I need days of time. And when the days get shorter, I'll need months of days. I'll ask for it back, the week that I lost. I'll claim it as mine. Say everything's fine. It's just that the week that I never knew I had was reported stolen. It was said I should feel aggrieved. I feel aggrieved. It's just how the mind perceives possession. Right, entitlement. I hope that I have it, the time that I'm due. I write from who? From me and you. For was it not for us the world was built? You and I, center of our circles, circling inwards. Pointillism when looked at from afar. And those that believe everything can be explained scratch and itch on their head, say, how could an increase in mass sustain itself with so few connections? Clear the stage for renegade lovers, connecting and connecting and connecting. Until the speakers telling you that you are you at the expense of others fall down around you. Distort the sound enough to distract you, make an odd buzzing as they fall. The end of which floods you with an appreciation for silence, wondering when the next time I'll be waked, asked my time of. Taken from the control room and given a high-vis vest with the rest of the lads. Told to tap plastic in ancient intervals, as another version of me sits back in the pocket of their comfort and starts shouting, output, 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 output. Output, output, output. Who freed him? Him there with the features. Him there by chance, him and I graced with a world we can't even taste, smell, nor incriminate. Well, you don't really know if you don't really know. And as egos flounder and bounce off each other in the insecurity of not knowing, a tightening and loosening. Ah, well, look here, see, I only ever wanted to run a tight ship while being loose as fuck. So I could say I'd grown as such, and I could grow to know so much that my brain might be on always while I never feel my pulse, one of many pulses undeclared at the border of we are all alive, and you are, and I am. Frail humans, so intolerant of the frailty of humans. Uncomfortable with ourselves, still here. Lost in a miscalculation of state. Showing up on a Sunday morning to the pitch where the game isn't being played. With a head full of ideas on how to defeat the opposing team, who may as well not exist now, alone in the stillness and the grass.
Thanks, you're off, Sean Ali Lynch.
I wrote this about events in the news that happened about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago. I read this last week, kind of read it to a beautiful pocket of me that were here, but I left emotions get the better of me. So I would like to read it again and hopefully not cry this time. The women of Ireland are mad at you. You won't treat us, you won't believe us, your scales are in need of a service. Lady Justice, Goddess Justitia, look at what's been done to you. You can't see too well. Your blindfold has been pulled too tight and left on so long that brambles and ivy have grown over your once optimistic eyes and left you lazy. Is that why you have let us down? If you are relying on just your ears, perhaps you could not hear us. There have been centuries of silence being shouted over and hushed. Can you hear us now? Because we are screaming. The banshee is sick of your shit, and she is howling. The sheogue are frantic with your lack of judgment and wonder if they accidentally cursed you many moons ago to make you so careless. They have no record of this, but fairies are not known for their bookkeeping. Off the coast of Connacht, Leinster, Munster and Ulster, the sirens sing a song of melancholy as the mermaids mock your millennia of meekness. The high goddesses of the Tuatha Dé Danann are quiet in their dispute of the island's namesake. Eru, in particular, has gone quite into herself. Her sisters are worried for her and all the sisters of the land, internally re-evaluating their performance as goddesses of sovereignty when what has been happening has happened for so long and for so many. They are squeezing the soil in anger, watering it with tears, pushing out yellow roses as the Bowron beats to the tune of grief. Can you hear them? They are screaming. Can you hear us? We are screaming, bring your scales back to Argos. There is something wrong with them. Take off that crusty blindfold, wash your eyes with chamomile and witch hazel, because there's something wrong with them. Clean out your ears with candle wax and come back to us, lady. Bring your voice and your sword, you are needed. We are screaming at you, for you, to hear us, to see us, to treat us, to believe us.
I kind of liked it with the emotion as well. Bernadette Gallo.
Yeah. worry. Do you realize there's a war going on? I didn't. Used to being stopped at security checkpoints, Strabane, Auchnacloy. Sounds of war do not stifle a 22-year-old. An Arab friend gently plucks stray hairs from my face, working thread with fingers. High fashion, handmade from burda patterns, covered for mosque with abaye. 5 women dressed in black on our way to Gilani Mosque. A letter goes astray to Tehran, but finds me safe on Haifa Street, Baghdad. Thank you.
That's about it. I want to say thank you to our lovely Barbara, because we're slightly over time, but she hasn't thrown anything at me. Thanks a million. It's been an unbelievable journey on the open mic. Thanks to everyone who contributed. Well done for those 5 words and the winner. And we have one more massive round of applause for our incredible audience.